Hello, everyone. This is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Micah Hanks. He has had a long fascination with the more unique scientific mysteries this world has to offer. And he's a self-proclaimed, but not self-righteous, skeptic. Micah works as a writer and researcher, as well as a radio personality whose work addresses a variety of unexplained phenomena. He's also an author of several books, and today we are going to discuss his latest one called The UFO Singularity. And he talks of that in terms of why are past unexplained phenomena changing our future, where will transcending the bounds of current thinking lead, and how near is singularity. So welcome to the program, Micah.
Well, thank you, Mike. Good to be here.
glad we managed to get the contact with you. I'll just say very briefly that I always like to confirm that you're still available a few days before the program, but my email to you got returned and I had no other means of contact. So I'm glad you were there ready waiting for us.
Oh, as always, yeah. I'm the same way, but you know how this stuff can get when it comes to Radio Land. It can get a little confusing at times. So glad to be here regardless.
Right, yes. I know you're very well versed in things such as radio interviews and so forth. I see from your background, I mean, it would take me about 10 minutes to read out all the things you've been involved in. You've obviously had a very strong interest in, well, the mysteries of the esoteric realms, the strange and the unusual, which is very much like myself. I feel we must be alike in that respect. And also, I've had a strong interest in UFOs myself since 1947 when I had my first sighting. I was only a young man then, of course. I think I was, let me remember, about 13, 14 years old. And I've always loved the mysteries, but not as mysteries, because I wouldn't mind betting you're probably the same. I like to know what is behind them so that they're no longer a mystery. So how did it come to you in those very early days?
Well, you know, I'm often asked that, and I have my folks to credit with this. You know, father, who was really kind of formative in getting me involved in interest in the strange and the unusual. I guess really it kind of began for me with, probably more than anything, cryptozoology. The possibility that there are animals that exist here on Earth that either little is known about them, or they may be as yet unacknowledged by science altogether. I remember when I was very young reading books about, for instance, giant squid and things like this. And of course, you know, very recently there's been a very very interesting looking film. We haven't seen the film yet, but we've seen a few stills of it, where Japanese film crews managed to capture footage of a live giant squid. I believe the taxonomical name for them may be Architeuthis or something along those lines. So I read a lot about that when I was a child. I was very interested in those kinds of things, but there were also books on ufology and, you know, the spectral kind of hauntings and things like that that followed soon after. And it really has been a lifelong interest. And I'm very interested in all these things. And I don't consider anything to be supernatural or paranormal in the sense that it will never be understood. I think that all things can be explained scientifically, but that in the same sense, you know, all things that are scientific begin as being paranormal or unexplained. And so that's, you know, where the two kind of meet. And there seems to be this dichotomy that some people seem to hope that there are things in this world that science will never explain. The mysteries of the space and time and the universe, and of course the potentials for, you know, divine intelligence as a god, if you will. I don't think that those things have to exist apart from one another, and I'm not one of those people who parks myself comfortably on one side of the fence or the other. I like to ride that fence a lot and, look at the potentials that kind of run down the middle.
Yes, indeed. I'm sure that really is the best way to approach it. So whereas you have been a skeptic, you're not biased one way or the other, so that makes, I'm sure, for much better reading where your work is concerned. Did you have any early UFO sightings yourself?
You know, There was one that kind of comes to mind. I often tell people that I've never had any kinds of verifiable experiences of my own in terms of UFO sightings and things like that. I do remember seeing a strange light in the sky on one occasion. I was about 5 years old, so I would have been in kindergarten. And I do recall going to school the next day and talking about it with some of the other students. A girl who was in my kindergarten class named Brandy, I shared the story with her, and she was convinced that what I'd seen was a spotlight that Pizza Hut had been delivering into the sky, says to invite people to come buy pizza. And it's funny, I remember that so specifically, and thinking at the time, even you know, that my friends, my young schoolmates, had a very different kind of perspective about the way that the world around us may work. And of course, being 5 years old, I also think it's interesting that I had enough of a grasp on the idea that there could have been something inexplicable, a bright light in the sky. Now, I asked my parents about it, and they said, no, that was just an airplane. And it probably was, because I'm willing to accept that my own young mind probably interpreted that phenomenon a bit fancifully. And so, and I'll say this too, Mike, when I say I'm a skeptic, you know, I was asked this, I've been asked this many times by radio hosts, and they'll talk with me enough and say, you know, I'm not getting a lot of skepticism off of you. But the thing is that I think that the difference between a person who goes about any kind of inquiry in a logical way and tries to utilize facts to determine the truth, as opposed to taking a bias or a preconception either for or against, you know, that to me is the essence of skepticism. And I differentiate myself from the typical quote-unquote skeptic in the sense that I'm not someone with a preconception toward disbelief that goes into my studies and tries to basically prop up my own preconceptions and debunk. The skeptical debunkers are typically that. They're people who say that this is something that can't exist and we're going to prove it, whereas I say, you know, I don't know whether it exists or not, and I hope to be able to arm myself with the facts to come to a final determination. And often I've found that truly when I can't prove conclusively, I'll theorize to a point, but often by remaining open-minded about something, it's even better, because if you don't commit wholeheartedly to an opinion on a matter when you aren't armed with the facts, you're able to look at things a lot more objectively. And so I kind of remain undecided on a lot of these issues when we lack the actual factual data to prove or to disprove.
Yes, indeed. Now, the subject of your book is UFOs, of course, and for me, my sighting was in about 1947. That was more or less, I think, the start of the big period of when there were sightings virtually every day, and it was very big news. So we're looking at about 65 years of activity. Did you find it hard to write a book about the UFO singularity, bearing in mind how much evidence or incidents have happened over such a long period?
That's a good question. You know, I didn't find it difficult, but I will say this, that there is a wealth of information out there, and what is difficult at times is, you know, finding the information that is the most reliable. I often talk with people, you know, I'm only 29 years old, and I'll often talk with people who'll say, you know, this and this has happened, you know, and they'll name a year and they'll say, but that was before your time. But being a student of history, you know, I try to keep myself well-versed in a lot of the different, you know, happenings, whether ufological or historically, you know, as they pertain to, you know, world wars or political happenings, you know, especially over the past century. You know, I'm very interested in all these sorts of things. And so for me, the only thing that's difficult, coming back to your question, is being able to separate the proverbial wheat from the chaff. Now, I find it very interesting that the UFO phenomenon seemed to just erupt the way that it did around that pivotal year of 1947, in coincidence with your own sighting. So that seemed to be a key period in our history, and I do look at that a bit in the book UFO Singularity, which primarily takes a futuristic approach to studying UFOs. I nonetheless find the history very interesting.
Yes. So, apart from this one light you saw when you were 5 years old, have you had any other possible sightings since?
I have seen what I would term probably a natural Earth-like manifestation in the Linville Gorge of western North Carolina. That I did not think. I mean, it would by definition be an unidentified flying object, because it appeared to be a glowing orb of light that was tracing the same track that the Linville River, I believe is what it's called, flows through down through this valley. And from my vantage point on top of what's called Table Rock, I was able to see this bright, brilliant red orb of light traveling along. Two of my companions had witnessed this. And of course, the one the one PhD professor in our midst was the one that missed it. So I've seen things like that. I wouldn't term them an intelligently controlled mechanical aircraft, however. Now, of course, I don't discount the potential that those kinds of things exist, because I've spoken with many eyewitnesses who have had that experience and who have seen these kinds of things. And clearly, there is some sort of a technological presence underlying the UFO phenomenon as well. Aside from my own scant encounters with lights in the sky from time to time that could not be identified, you know, I've had to play the role of the journalist who collects and gathers data and then tries to disseminate some of that in a rational way. But I certainly believe that there's more to the UFO enigma than just the little lights in the sky that I've seen over the years.
Yes. Do you find that in the more recent years, and by that I possibly mean 20, 30, 40 years, that collecting information and deciding what basis or place it has in your view, it gets harder because of the evidence that the US government has already developed anti-gravity craft and has possibly a fleet of spacecrafts already?
There's that potential, yeah. And it seems that my gut tells me that there probably are a variety of technologies available to the world governments today that we, you know, on the common level, know very little or nothing about. So that muddies the waters, so to speak. It seems pretty clear that in 1947, I'm not going to say that we didn't. I'm just going to say that it seems clear that in all likelihood, we couldn't have possessed technologies right after the war that would have far exceeded what had been used already in wartime. If not, if that weren't the case, you know, again, why would it be that the Allies or the Axis powers, for that matter, would not have used these in combat? Nonetheless, there were what appeared to be very highly advanced technological aircraft that were seen immediately following the war. Some of those may have been, you know, test craft and things like that. Who knows? I mean, and I think a key point that should be made here is that immediately following the Second World War, probably the world governments, it wasn't a matter of, well, the war's over and now everything's fine. I mean, those people, they remained on, and I say those people, I mean, you know, of course, those in upper echelons of government, we all remained on this kind of high level of you know, awareness and alertness. And there was probably more than anything a greater need and necessity among the two major superpowers to try and innovate and to design new kinds of technologies for use in the potential that always could exist, and that would be, you know, God forbid, another war, World War III. Throughout the entire Cold War, the major superpowers remained terrified of that potential and that possibility. And so these UFO reports became very disconcerting at times, and it was always a question, does one side or the other have this technology, and could they ever use it against us? And even today, yes, if those kinds of technologies are still being developed in clandestine ways, if there's anything else going on in the UFO arena, which I suspect personally that very well may be the case, maybe extraterrestrial, ultra-dimensional, to borrow the words of John Keel or something along those lines, I do think that it becomes more and more difficult as time goes on to differentiate between what is ours and quote-unquote theirs. Again, that's something I talk about in the UFO singularity and reaching that point beyond which our technology begins to mirror what may be extraterrestrial, or whatever else it could be, to the point that we won't be able to tell the difference, and we will be literally leveling that playing field between ourselves and what may be other intelligences out there.
Yes, that's something I certainly agree with, just based on my own readings and my own conclusions. Obviously not as vast as yours, but it's interesting that you do come across with that particular point. Of course, over the last, I don't know, again, perhaps some 30, 40 years or more, it seems wherever there have been UFO crashes, maybe all over the world, the US government's been pretty prominent in retrieving crashed craft, and they've been taken away, and we've heard many stories about them having been back-engineered. So it wouldn't be, I guess, surprising at all if they had managed to gather so much information through back engineering that they were able to at least produce some early type of craft. Have you come across any evidence of that?
Well, you know, there's always anecdotal evidence. I do think that there was something that happened at Roswell Roswell, New Mexico, of course. I don't know that we can prove, and again, I'm not going to say it wasn't, but I don't know that I could prove to you today that whatever happened at Roswell was extraterrestrial in nature. You know, some of the recollections of Philip Corso, as described in books like The Day After Roswell, certainly talk about different kinds of technologies that were allegedly recovered from the craft wreckage that were very similar, if not strikingly similar, to things that the Nazis had been developing in Nazi Germany. And they'd even field tested some of these kinds of technologies, specifically, well, I think what they'd called a cascade ion technology, an early variety of laser technology, Kevlar, things like this. The Nazis were producing a lot of different things, and I'm not saying that immediately following the Second World War that somehow the Nazis had managed to crash-land a flying saucer in Roswell, New Mexico, but it is interesting that that parallel between Earth technologies that were being developed and innovated during the war, also in the recollections of Corso and a few others, apparently were found there at Roswell. So when it comes to crash landings, you know, what are these things? Let's look at Kecksburg again. The Kecksburg craft, you know, bears not only a stark similarity to some of the modern Soyuz capsules and things like that that are utilized by the Soviet space programs, but also that alleged Bell project, Die Glocke, that the Nazis were working on very covertly. Hermann Oberth and a few others were allegedly involved with that, as well as a chap named Ronald Richter, who may have come across the Great Waters after the war and gone to work in Argentina. Joseph Farrell, Jim Mars, and many of the popular conspiracy authors have talked about these sorts of scenarios. And while we can't prove them, they offer a unique alternative, which is, personally, Mike, it's as interesting to me as the potential for extraterrestrial visitation, and that is, what if there are earthbound technologies that are utilizing this sort of innovation, whether it be aeronautics, physics, or whatever, or a combination of all these things, to create a technology that appears to be greater than what we know natural levels of human technology available to us today may be? Or could it be a combination, as you'd said? What if there were craft that were recovered, perhaps back-engineered, and that's how we obtained that technology just as well? The potentials are very exciting, but I think that we so often see in ufology that researchers gravitate toward extraterrestrial explanations for all this because there just seems to be nothing else that this could possibly be. In my book, I look at a lot of different other potentials. What if there is some sort of a alternative dimension aspect to this? In other words, could there be dimensional aberrations or anomalies that constitute some UFO reports? What if in the future our own progeny, our eventual progeny rather, actually develop some functional ability to travel through time? But all these things should perhaps be taken into consideration just as well. And the two of those, whether it be a dimensional phenomenon, a non-temporal or time-based phenomenon, and then, of course, the potential for clandestine technologies in our midst today, all three of those in a roundabout way could have more to do with, you know, humankind and technologies that emanate from someplace closer to here rather than somewhere out there. And they all three tend to help us get around the complex issues involved with extraterrestrial colonization of space and travel from great distances, hundreds of thousands of light years away, as we would propose extraterrestrials would have to do.
My goodness, you've touched upon a lot of points there. I certainly believe that we are being visited by extraterrestrial beings with their craft, and I believe the objection that was put up perhaps many years ago, and with some people even today, that they couldn't possibly get here because of the distance away they were, has been explained, I think, satisfactorily by interdimensional travel, which I think is what you hinted at there. Mm-hmm. So if ETs have made contact with us, and there's some strong rumours that they actually contacted the Germans during World War II and gave them information that had enabled them to develop craft already at that stage. There are allegedly photographs of the craft which looks very similar to one of the Venusian scout craft that were photographed quite a lot during the mid-century. So it does make you wonder sometimes. I mean, it's interesting that you mention about the Germans and their possible capability. And there is a suggestion that that even got to the point where they were beginning to manufacture some type of advanced craft. So did you come across any of these aspects that I've just mentioned?
I certainly have, yeah. Especially, I'm very interested in the World War II years And many people who have maybe studied what I talk about, or you know, at very least have a peripheral idea of, you know, what I try to get into with the UFO singularity, they see this, and right there on the front of the book it asks, you know, why are past unexplained phenomena changing our future? And people say, well, what does this have to do with the future? Why are you interested in World War II if what you're trying to talk about here has to do more with the Second World War? That is an interesting period in history, you know. There are the anecdotal reports that talk about the Nazis potentially obtaining some kind of an advanced technology, and they may have utilized that to develop maybe what some of the early saucer designs are. You know, there are many who report to, and actually there have been some documents that have surfaced over the years that report to show actual layouts and blueprints for craft that had been given names along the lines of the Honeyboo and the Vril, some of these different things. What is interesting, though, about the UFO reports that come out following the Second World War that allege that the Nazis have been building these technologies, or at very least had created designs for the building of these craft at some point eventually, none of these reports actually surfaced during the war years that we know of. All those reports, many of them actually, you know, carried by mainstream news sources such as the New York Times and several others across the sea, they tend to look at the phenomenon from the perspective of what if the Nazis had been building this, and all of those reports began to appear no earlier than 1949. And so the question that I ask is, could it be that in the appearance of, let's just presume for a moment, this is getting a bit conspiratorial, but it's a fun thought game, I guess. Let's assume that these craft that begin to appear are either maybe extraterrestrial, or perhaps they are some sort of a dimensional manifestation, something that would not be our own. Okay, if after the Second World War, the major superpowers had hoped to be able to cash in on the apparent presence of these advanced technologies and concern me, how better to go about doing that, perhaps, than to release these kinds of reports to the mainstream media talking about the fact that the Germans had, in fact, been building what effectively would be termed flying saucers. Now, let's say that, for instance, if we were sitting there in our home in Moscow and read a New York Times report talking about secret Nazi technologies, and the world is, of course, facing this apparent UFO problem that the Air Force is looking into with Project Blue Book, wouldn't it make us wonder, sitting there reading our newspaper in Russia, what if the Allies had managed to capture, or rather maybe more concisely put, maybe the United States had managed to capture Nazi scientists who were working on these projects, and what if they now are working for the U.S.? It would be natural, to my way of thinking, that this would cause a lot of confusion and quite a lot of paranoia just as well. And so what if it had been for purposes of actually trying to cause that kind of confusion and to concern the enemy during the Cold War years so as to maybe work as a variety of deterrent to entering another war? This is one possibility, but that possibility points to something else, that if indeed a lot of the reports about the Nazi technologies were merely propaganda, then perhaps these UFO craft that were being seen, which were the object of the propaganda, were actually coming from someplace else. Again, the big question there is, where did they come from? Extraterrestrial, ultra-dimensional, time travelers from our future, maybe some sort of a hidden technology that has been closer to Earth, but maybe not right here in our midst for much longer than we realize. It could be any number of potentials, but I think that that's something that should be taken into consideration with regard to the Nazis and their technology. There's very little evidence that shows that the Nazis were actually building these kind of craft, and if they were, that they, pardon the pun, but got them off the ground. Much the contrary, I think that there was a lot of propaganda and a lot of misinformation, and to this day there still is. And we're left with an entire host of potentials as to what these UFO craft, which obviously do appear to exist, what they may actually be, that remains a mystery.
Yes. I think that after World War II, it is perhaps, I'd like to think, common knowledge now, but perhaps it's not so common unless you're interested in it and you search out the information, that von Braun, who I think was the man behind the V-2 rocket, was picked up by the US. I think that was under their project called Paperclip or something like that, when they took him and some other geniuses, I guess, in that type of application. And I'm thinking to myself that in that case, since he had no objection to working with the US, if there were any secrets about the German development of such flying craft, he undoubtedly would have passed the information on. So it may be the US had a head start over everybody else in developing that field.
It could be that that is actually the case. I've also heard stories about Wernher von Braun, who may have, again, of course, been next to Hermann. I believe it was Hermann Oberth, the father of the modern rocketry. Of course, I think von Braun had been a protege of sorts to Oberth. But von Braun had allegedly told one of his aides or an assistant at some point that the entire extraterrestrial mythos was going to, blow open, and that there was going to be a great big revelation later on down the road. I don't recall precisely who had said this, but there are documentaries, articles that talk about that. So, the connection between a lot of these propulsion scientists and people like, von Braun, who had worked for the Nazis and then later came to the United States, whose technological prowess was employed by the Allied powers. There's definitely a connection between some of those characters in the UFO enigma. And again, to me, it gets into one of two areas, and it's rather simplistic to go ahead and just say, well, there are one or two things. Surely there are a variety of possibilities, but for simplicity's sake, I'll say here that in all likelihood, there was either a vast and very complex misinformation campaign that some of these characters were directly involved in, or they knew very little about the actual phenomenon that constituted the UFO mythos, and that in truth what was going on was something that was far beyond the scope of what most of the modern scientists immediately following the war were capable of dealing with. And so when we talk about this in relation to future technologies, my colleague Mac Maloney, who wrote a book called UFOs in Wartime, I interviewed him for my own book, The UFO Singularity, and I said, Mac, you've been interested in the prevalence of UFO reports during wartime. Your thesis is that these UFO incidents tend to rise during wartime, and of course, we also see the parallel between UFOs appearing at nuclear weapons test sites and military installations. I was reading a fascinating story today about, I think, Fort Campbell on the Kentucky-Tennessee border. It had been a MUFON report where a man had actually claimed that he had had a close encounter with a landed saucer. Well, it hadn't actually landed. It had come down to land level, but was hovering off the ground. And the man had essentially had this close encounter, I believe what Dr. J. Allen Hynek would have called a close encounter of the second kind. And this occurred on a military base during a training exercise that involved using lasers that were fired out into the distance, which would have been, of course, visible for a long distance. And the final supposition was that if these were extraterrestrial craft, they had been attracted to the showing of the lasers and had come down to see what the humans were doing, so to speak. So now I can't speak to the veracity of a story like that, but these stories, anecdotally and otherwise, if we're to study the great grand scheme of things in terms of UFOs, they're very interesting to me. And what they do tend to point to is the same premise that Mac Maloney puts forth in his book, that UFO incidents tend to go on the rise during wartime and in conjunction with militaristic activities. And Mac's theory, when I asked him, I said, what do you think these things are? Extraterrestrials that are coming in and protecting us from ourselves, or are they nascent technologies that were created right here on Earth? And Mac's theory was that, well, if they're extraterrestrial, that's one possibility, but they seem to show a lot of interest in the goings-on here on Earth. On the other hand, if these were some Earth technology, why wouldn't they show more evasive technologies and abilities to literally engage in combat and things like that? If one side or the other had used them, how come we don't see these sorts of craft getting involved in actual wartime activities? So Mac's theory is a bit different. He said, I can only suppose that these might be time travelers from the future, and that these craft are capable of coming and witnessing and observing without having to get involved. And he said, when you study the history of UFOs appearing during war conflicts and things like that, and you hear so many stories about a quote-unquote Foo Fighter that's flying alongside a 17 bomber right off the right wing and keeping pace with this craft but not engaging and not getting involved in the battle, he says you have to wonder if there wouldn't be a technology from the future that would want nothing more than just to be able to come back and observe battles, these pivotal points in history, and to actually observe them. So I think that that's a bold hypothesis, but perhaps just as much a potential as anything else.
Well, firstly, it sounds a very good one to me, because as you undoubtedly know, the Foo Fighters were not choosy in which side they tracked and took whatever information they were seeking. The Germans apparently thought that the Foo Fighters belonged to the Allies and vice versa. So whatever they were doing, they were there, I guess, collecting some sort of information. Now, There was a, or there is rather, a very well-known incident of a landing and contact with ETs in England, of the Randlesham Forest case. And the officer involved in that, I've forgotten his name off the cuff, was it Hall, made a very excellent report, which, looking at it from a military point of view, is possibly very difficult to deny because of the nature of the way that the military make out their reports, very precise and detailed. But there also is a rumour that after the Randlesham Forest sighting and contact, that the craft or a craft appeared a little later and actually landed by arrangement inside the American base there. And they were met by an officer and other personnel. We don't know what was said or what the nature of it was, but there are other military personnel that were allegedly a witness to that. Now, in your research, has anything about that come out?
Well, you know, what I do know about the Randlesham situation is that, of course, the popular skeptical perspective is that there had been, I think, a lighthouse off in the distance, and that the lights from the lighthouse could have been what they'd seen. But in my opinion, I like to give credence to people who are trained members of the military and say that if they see what appears to be a craft landed in the forest, they're not going to mistake a lighthouse far off in the distance, you know, a known quantity, in other words, for being a landed craft, you know, that's red and blue and different colors and illuminated by strange, you know, luminescent lighting. Now, what's interesting about the Randlesham case is that later on, gosh, you know, and I'm trying to remember all the names just as well, because I'm by no means an expert in the mythology and the history and the reports surrounding that particular case, but it was brought to my attention, I believe, and of course this has been discussed on the popular program Ancient Aliens, which I don't watch that much because I don't even keep a television in my house. I'm a writer, and you can get everything on the internet these days. but the story goes that one of the two witnesses had claimed that he had been given essentially what was a binary code, and he had jotted down a series of ones and zeros. And again, I think people who are more familiar with the case will just be rolling their eyes because of my woeful inability to recall the name of the gentleman. But the case is that, as I understand it, that information came out much later about the alleged binary code. One attempt to decipher the code did seem to impart a very, albeit jarbled and somewhat, or rather garbled up and kind of broken message, but it did seem to entail what could be interpreted as a message from an intelligence from elsewhere. And one of the conclusions about that Randlesham incident was, among ufologists, that they thought it might have represented some kind of a technology from the future coming back and trying to interact with the present day. Who really knows? There are a lot of different potentials. It remains one of those incredible cases, though, that has really kind of stood out among the rest, and there seems to remain a lot of popular interest in that particular incident.
Yes. I haven't personally read or heard of the binary code message. That's an interesting one. Okay. Have you done a lot of research in connection with what goes on at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, in as much that it is alleged that every body retrieved from a crash craft that is alien has been taken to Wright-Patterson Base? And also, of course, in their normal way of working, they have developed many advanced craft, and possibly the anti-gravity craft that some people refer to. What do you know about that side of the business?
Well, you know, it's funny because I've never toured or visited a military base or an Air Force base. I would certainly like to. There have always been the conspiracies about, saucers and, of course, bodies taken to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. The closest I could come to that was it was actually at an event, but at the bar in a restaurant in a hotel at a UFO event on one occasion, there was a gentleman who sat down next to me and ordered a Cuban sandwich and told me that he had used to work in the at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and had told me a rather compelling story about some documents that had gone missing. And what he alleged was that it would be very difficult for documents to have, gone missing from an Air Force base like that. He didn't directly equate this with UFOs, but, I have to ask if if documents and things could go missing from a high security installation like that, you know, who has the ability to get in there and get those things? And those who think a little more conspiratorial, I suppose, would ask perhaps, well, is there some sort of a conspiracy of silence from within? And does this involve some people who are of, you know, high rank in American military and elsewhere in other parts of the world with among and amidst officialdom? Is there something that's going on that involves people who are capable of accessing high security locations, gaining access to information and spiriting that away or copying or divulging it to, you know, to other parties elsewhere? Which comes to an interesting question. Researcher Richard Dolan has talked a lot about what he calls the potential for a breakaway civilization. What if a certain portion of civilization here on Earth were utilizing covertly and perhaps privately funded advanced technologies to literally break apart from the conventional model of what we know to be human civilization here on planet Earth? And this gets to this idea of there being a secret space program and perhaps something working in tandem with presumed extraterrestrial technologies. I'll tell you right now, Mike, I can give you absolutely no proof that that's what's going on. But I think, and in Rich's defense, we have to be able to speculate about things like that in terms of coming to a better understanding of the UFO phenomenon in general and the greater mysteries that may be entailing what we call UFOs. So, you know, I give Rich a pat on the back for that and for trying to think outside the conventional model of UFO equals extraterrestrial, which, again, I want to point out, I don't want to say that UFOs aren't extraterrestrial. I do believe, and I'll tell you this, I can't prove that any better than I can prove breakaway civilizations, time travelers, or anything else. But in my heart, I feel that there are, without question, other intelligences out there in our universe, probably which are far more advanced than us. In some instances, they may be far less advanced and more archaic in their building of various technologies. But nonetheless, I believe that alien life exists. Whether they are visiting Earth remains inconclusive, but it's a stark potential. And when we're faced with the presence of technological, whatever these things are, I almost say creatures, to borrow Trevor James Constable's old, or critters, I think is what he'd referred to them as. He actually thought some of those might be some sort of a biological organism unto themselves. Maybe some of them are, for all we know. But there are so many different potentials, we have to take them all into consideration in hopes of trying to come to a fuller understanding of what UFOs may be. And I do think, certainly, that there's a possibility that we could be dealing with a variety of extraterrestrial technologies as much as anything else. I just like it when researchers think outside the box a little, because it's refreshing and it gives us new alternatives to explore.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the human civilization is very young in terms of what we can see when we look out around us into the universe. So I think we have to feel undoubtedly that there are some civilizations that are millions of years ahead of us. And you have to wonder what their technologies are like, assuming that they still use them.
Yes, or would we as humans be able to even perceive those kinds of technologies? Would they be so alien to us and perhaps so much more advanced than what we have available to us at the present day? Would we be able to even perceive those technologies? And at what point does what we call synthetic or digital or technological, at what point does that literally traverse the bounds of what you or I might look at and call organic? We say that there's this clear distinction between what is organic and what is synthetic, but I think that the height of technology, or at least, you know, a stage farther, much farther along than where we are right now, would have to be able to utilize matter technologically to create the apparent presence of organic things, beings perhaps, or perhaps even planets, and perhaps even universes. So it brings into question the whole notion of what are we, where are we from, is what we perceive as reality. What is that a construct of, and could that have also been created by what, you know, again, we would call some non-human extraterrestrial intelligence?
Absolutely. It's interesting, I think, that I recall that when someone examined a human fetus, what they found, that is obviously in early stages of development, they found that it actually had a tau, and that made them believe that we were some sort of hybrid, that at some time must have been genetically engineered with reptilians. So you've got these people thinking outside the box that look at something that everybody's looked at for years and hasn't seen it. And I think that it's good because it makes people think.
Yeah, I would agree. And that's the whole point, is that I think more of us have to think. We have to learn to think outside the box. You know, my publicist referred to this book, The UFO Singularity, as being, you know, a book that deals with UFOs in our future. And, of course, they've put out a tagline a few times that reads, "The Secrets of UFO Phenomena Revealed." But, you know, and not to dispel that as a rumor, but I certainly don't claim to have secrets about ufology that that no one else has access to. You know, I was asked by a producer recently before I went on a radio program. They said, "Do you have contacts in government?" And my initial answer to that question, Mike, was no, I do not. In truth, I guess you could say that I do, only in the sense that, you know, I've spoken over the years with a lot of people who either had been in the space program, or some of them may still work in the space program, but I don't consider a person who has a desk job, you know, or who might work at a, you know, flight control center or something with NASA or something, or any such agency, I don't consider that to be a secret contact up there. You know, I feel that these people come to me because they know just as little as anyone else, and they're interested in UFO phenomena or other kinds of phenomena. Some of my friends, you know, in the you know, who work a little closer to officialdom, they take very little interest in UFOs, and they're all interested in psychic phenomena or cryptozoology, these sorts of things. You know, we all have interests, and just because a person might work with the space program, or they might work, you know, for the FBI or the CIA, that doesn't mean that that person can't be a human too, and that they can't have interests. I can certainly tell you I don't have contacts in the FBI and the CIA feeding me secrets about UFOs. I'd prefer not to be like that. I'd prefer just to be an average guy who tries to think outside the box and look at this phenomena in a way that is a little bit more you know, I guess off the cuff, and that seeks to explore the potentials that may be awaiting us, not only here present with the different potentials underlying ufology, but also what future technology that we as humans will create. What kind of technology will, again, level that playing field, and how long before we will actually be creating such mechanizations, you know, aircraft and things like that, that are on par with what we already see in UFO reports. At that point, will it be such an important question as to whether or not Earth has been visited? When we have technology that can take us to a distant star system, will we be concerned with whether aliens are visiting Earth? I don't know. You know, but that future probably is right around the corner and a little closer than a lot of people are willing to probably admit or entertain, at least.
Yeah, it just shows what a big subject it is, and I guess you could never find enough time to really study it very deeply, but intuitively you obviously have a feeling about where the truth lies, and you follow that, and that works well for you. But if I may just briefly go back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, I have seen on a few occasions people give evidence that work there, and a few of them accidentally walked into Hangar 18 and they saw what by any other reckoning would be, well, flying craft. So I guess you must have heard of that.
You know, the famous stories of Hangar 18. I'm also reminded of a heavy metal song that was written a few decades ago that was called Hangar 18. You know, I've heard some of those stories, and it's obviously the sort of thing that is artists and musicians and fiction writers and people have drawn influence from those kinds of stories over the years. When I look at ufology, I try not to, you know, and here's the thing, Mike, and this is what I don't wear this like a badge, but I would at least, you know, state that for practical purposes, what differentiates me a bit from the average ufologist is that as opposed to being someone who, and I love World War II and obviously the potentials for nascent technologies that may have begun to exist around the time of the Second World War, but I'm not the kind of person who just looks at the history of ufology and, for instance, the Roswell crash or Wright-Patterson Air Force Base or, you know, the Betty and Barney Hill abduction, or, you know, I'm well-versed in all that, in all those stories and all those reports and encounters and claims, but, you know, I got to a point where I continued to read these things and was fascinated with them, and then I started realizing that, you know, if I just regurgitate, pardon the expression, but if I just, you know, kind of put these same stories out there and write about them and rehash them and rehash them and rehash them, like so many writers and bloggers out there do, I realized that I'm not really getting to the bottom of anything, am I? There are people. And you know what? In this economy, more power to them. You know, I'm not going to tell anyone how or why they should or should not be able to make a living doing what they love. But there are a lot of researchers out there who, you know, might just dig up these old reports, or they might find a new slant on an old report or something like that. I try not to be the person who does that. I try to be the person who, rather than just collecting and categorizing and then just doing nothing with, I try to look at reports and I try to discern a little bit more and look at something a little deeper, in addition to watching technological trends and looking to the future, in an effort to try and kind of do guesswork about where the technology may lead us or where our own technological prowess may allow us to go with it in the coming years. That is really the goal that I try to do. And if people go to my website, graylianreport.com, that site, you'll find a lot of information and a lot of, you know, different kinds of subjects being treated, not just UFOs, not just cryptozoology, also science and technology, psychic phenomenon, you know, these sorts of things, because I try to look at all these things and in a cumulative way, see where it's going to be taking us. That's my approach, and unfortunately, it hasn't made me incredibly popular in the UFO and paranormal website circuits and things like that. I don't get quite as often, the friendly linkage at the websites because of that. But you know, that's okay, because that's a path I've chosen. You know, if you can't beat them, they say join them. But I decided just to take off and do my own thing. So, you know, and that's where I am. And so, unfortunately, I'm highly under-equipped to discuss with any kind of legitimacy Hangar 18 or anything like that, because, you know, my research has taken a slightly different direction with things. So.
Well, one can say you're certainly very original in your approach, and that of course, makes it more interesting to talk with you or read your books. Now, I think one of the problems when we talk of ETs is that, as far as one can ascertain from people who alleged to have seen them or met them, etc., is that there appear to be a number of different races that are very human-looking, and it is said that there are one or two that if they were to be amongst us, you wouldn't actually know the difference between them and ourselves. Now, that might be supported, although I don't know whether it can even be proven now, that many years ago, but after World War II, it was alleged that a human, an ET rather, of human appearance, who gave his name as Thor, actually appeared at the United Nations and took a seat there for a period of time. I mean weeks, months, or maybe a year or so, as a representative of the extraterrestrials. I mean, that's a story in itself. There were photographs of him at the United Nations. And I think the guy who was mainly responsible for bringing that out was somebody called Dr. Strange. And I think that's his real name.
Like that.
But the point I'm making there is that if that is so, that a lot of the extraterrestrials are human-like in their appearance and they are amongst us and doing things, make it very difficult to pin them down. I mean, if you were looking for a little green man, it might be easier.
Well, you know, that's a key point that I think that we have this misconception maybe about what extraterrestrial life would be like. Now, I'll tell you this. In my experience, I hear these stories of, for instance, the Betty and Barney Hill abduction, which, if I remember correctly, if we were to take into consideration especially things like screen memories that many abductees claim to have, there's a problem with the abduction scenario as it stands, and that is that often the memories of witnesses as recalled from, you know, from actual memory, as opposed to what is recollected post-hypnotic regression, tends to differ. I believe that in the instance of Betty and Barney Hill, of course, you know, after Dr. Benjamin Simon conducted a hypnosis session, these beings that were remembered by the Hills, they looked very much like the modern conception of what an alien gray would be, you know, large head, dark eyes, things like that. Hmm. Whereas prior to the hypnotic regression, what Betty Hill had claimed to remember through dreams had been an ongoing encounter, I guess. Maybe not ongoing. I think that there had been some claim of this sort of thing. And I know that certainly Betty's sister, a few weeks prior to their own encounter, as they were headed back, toward Massachusetts, Betty's sister had actually seen a UFO just as well, and so it was on her mind, and some would bring into question the potentials for abductions occurring throughout, you know, history and midst families, and that maybe Betty's sister had been involved somehow as well. But what we do know is that Betty described initially that phenomenon as being, having had to do more with little men in flight suits I believe that she'd said they had large noses or jet black hair or, you know, different kinds of features like this. And then after the regression, the appearance of these creatures changed somewhat. Now, some would say that that was a screen memory and that what had happened was that, that Betty and Barney actually were abducted by alien beings and that they had had a screen memory planted to make them look more like little people. Another interesting point is that Betty had also recalled these little people having German accents. So in a way, you could almost see a brief parallel that's made there between the Nazi UFO mythos and the Betty and Barney Hill abduction. I think that's very interesting, and it's often left entirely out of people's written accounts over the years of what happened to the Hills that evening. So it's also important to point out that they also had gone and lectured at least, I think, one UFO meetup there near their hometown. And they had been involved somewhat, following their encounter with ufology as it was back in the day prior to having had that regression. And what I'm getting at here is that the conception of what a UFO is, or rather, I shouldn't say UFO, but what an alien being is built largely off of a mythos, an abduction mythos that, in truth has a lot of shaky ground. I think many of the abductees would say this. I appeared on Whitley Strieber's Dreamland podcast yesterday, and we had a brilliant discussion about this in the way that often a lot of the abductions seem to be more quasi-physical as opposed to a full-on physical phenomenon. Now, Whitley will tell you that many of his, especially his early experiences, couldn't have been anything but physical. And I tend to think that there is certainly some physical component to this, especially after speaking with people who seem very credible to me, like Whitley Strieber. But by the same token, I think that even Strieber and others in the abduction field have acknowledged that there's often a non-physical component to all this, and furthermore that the descriptions of aliens often differ. As you pointed out, Mike, sometimes they look very human. That would be awful difficult to try and pin one down if they looked just like you or I. By the same token, there are craft that are described as being flying saucers from which an entire host of different kinds of beings have allegedly emerged, according to eyewitness encounters over the years. If we look at the Pascagoula abduction of 1973, these things were one-legged, elephant-skinned creatures with carrots for noses and ears. If we look at my friend Chris Bledsoe's encounter, which took place right over here in Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is very near where I live, Chris would tell you that these things had resembled, if anything, little armored characters, that had some sort of visors over their eyes, and that they were diminutive, almost similar to those famous Hopkinsville goblins from the Hopkinsville-Kelly incident that took place so many decades ago near Kelly, West Virginia, or it was Hopkinsville, I guess Kentucky, actually. So, but the nearby town was Kelly as well. So the point is that the descriptions of the beings often vary. Sometimes they're human-like, sometimes they're grays, and sometimes they're things that are almost indescribable. But the underlying key here is that when we go looking for alien life, we typically aren't looking, in my opinion, for aliens. We're looking for humans. We're trying to fathom what alien life would be like on anthropomorphic human-esque terms. They would have to have torsos and two arms and two legs and a head. If alien life were nothing like that of any sort, would we recognize them any better standing right here in our midst than if those aliens looked just like you or I? If there were a non-physical entity that were capable of moving into a living room and standing there with you and that the human senses couldn't perceive, it could very well be in some capacity a physical being, but it could be just as difficult to try and spot and pin down as those quote-unquote human-esque aliens, So there are a lot of potentials that need to be asked and explored when it comes to what quote-unquote alien life may actually entail.
Yes, I agree with you absolutely, because where people again have had alleged contacts, I think often the beings have literally just simply appeared in front of them. In other words, they seem to be able to alter the frequency of their body. They can be seen when they want to and be invisible when they want to.
Right.
So do you think that might be some development in our own evolution that might come in the future, where we will have these type of abilities, like interdimensional travel, to be a time traveler ourselves?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I do think that. I think, if anything, that maybe a non-physical form of some sort, whether by virtue of an evolutionary process or, you know, by some technological achievement on down the road, it very well may be that the height, the pinnacle of all intelligence is that which transcends the physical altogether. Mm-hmm. And who's to say, in a strange sense, that humans aren't already, in terms of their evolution, capable of doing this, and that rather than being the end, perhaps death is just a stage. Perhaps the living body that we have here is something of a cocoon, and that when we emerge from this cocoon, we erupt into a more enlightened, non-physical state of intelligence, and that that's the next step. And that would say a lot, too, to me, about the great silence. We always wonder about why there's so little evidence, you know, at least in terms of cosmology and our attempts at trying to find intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. Many would argue, without question, that UFOs obviously represent extraterrestrial life that's already been here. But the scientific establishment may differ on that point. And if we're to lend credence to that notion that, well, we can't find evidence of alien life visiting Earth, what if the reason why is because, truly, in order for us to find advanced intelligences elsewhere, we'll have to transcend the physical ourselves. You know, and I'm not advocating, you know, what the UFO cults sometimes have engaged in over the years. You know, if we think about Heaven's Gate and things like that, they see a comet flying into, you know, near Earth's atmosphere, and of course, well, not near the atmosphere, but at very least, you know, within sight of Earth, visible by the naked eye, speaking specifically of the Hale-Bopp comet there, you know, these UFO cults, and I term them a UFO cult because they did apparently believe that a flying saucer was following in the dust tail of the comet Hale-Bopp, and of course we saw what happened to the Heaven's Gate followers. They committed suicide. So I think it's very dangerous when we start supposing that, you know, UFO intelligences are the be-all end-all, and that we should all, you know, give up our conception of a religion or spirituality, and we should, you know, transfer that over to these alien saviors or anything. That's not what I'm saying in the least, but I will certainly say that it may be that we would have to transcend the physical, either technologically or otherwise, at some point in order to take the next step and be able to have that kind of reconciliation with the non-physical intelligence, which essentially is what happens in 2001 A Space Odyssey. Keep in mind, we go to Jupiter and beyond the infinite. We don't go and meet little gray men standing there. No, it was a situation that essentially required transcending the physical, for the astronaut in that instance to be able to actually have that that exchange with the whatever the intelligence actually was.
Yes, I have to think we're part of the way there, in the sense that you mentioned, supposing we can transcend our physical body. I believe in reincarnation, and that there we have a soul that does leave the physical body at the point of death. So if we then have another aspect of ourself which can be seen by psychics, I think, and mediums, but not generally, it does make you wonder how far it can go. I mean, what is the ultimate?
That's right. Yeah, that's where that could take us. It may be something that really literally pushes the bounds of human conception and perception to a point that we may not be capable of fully understanding the implications there, you know, with our natural levels of human intelligence available to us today. And again, when we talk about the UFO singularity, one of the underlying ideas there is the concept of technological singularity, and that maybe we'll utilize technologies in the future to augment natural levels of human intelligence, you know, so that we can actually perceive more about our universe around us and perhaps the reality that we think we know right now. And in the event that we do that successfully, and that we're able to perceive levels of our reality that maybe, are kept apart from us and are imperceptible to humanity at present, once we reach that point, there may be an entire host of different intelligences that become very apparent to us, and that will be a real game changer in terms of maybe not only just, you know, human technological progression, but also to an extent our own development and our own evolution.
Yes, I agree with you there, absolutely. There are people that believe we will reach a stage in the not-too-distant future where we will be able to move from one point to another instantaneously by pure thought.
That would be a very interesting potential. I guess that would entail teleportation, I guess, you know, effective teleportation technology. And if we get to that point, you know, many times people think, okay, well, teleportation via a machine, you know, I step into a machine and beam me up, Scotty, as they used to say on Star Trek. But what if it were more along the lines of what the remote viewers have allegedly already managed to learn to do, where they can, you know, focus on a location, transcend the physical body, and travel to a location remotely, see that, and learn about that that place, and utilize that ability for purposes of finding missing, you know, persons, and you know, spying, espionage, all different sorts of things. It's a very interesting.
Absolutely. I suspect you possibly know more about that than you're mentioning at the moment, because I'm sure with your interest in these subjects, you must at some time have come across the allegations that the US have already developed this type of time travel, and there is an object, shall I call it, that's like a lift that they get into and press a few buttons, presumably to fill in the location they want to move to, and they are there within sort of a minute or two. I'm not describing it very well, but what I'm trying to say is I believe they have already experimented and have that sort of ability, and there is talk of them having already used it to create a base on Mars.
I've heard those stories, yes, and they some of them even tie President Barack Obama in with early
descriptions of Mars. Right, yes.
Things like that, you know. Again, I couldn't begin to tell you if there's any truth to stories like that. My gut would tell me that it may be a combination of certain technologies that actually do exist and wild, fanciful conspiracy theories that are more meant to entertain than to actually educate. But, you know, again, who really knows what's going on? You know, I take some of those stories with a grain of salt, especially those that entail our commander-in-chief, you know, traveling to Mars and things like that. But who knows? You know, truth I've often found in this field is stranger than fiction.
Well, yes, if something I think keeps coming up, you begin to think, hello, maybe there is something in that. It's different to something that comes up in complete isolation and isn't really backed up or followed by any other similar information. I mean, the guy who's put out a lot of information about these trips to Mars, which he has made himself, is Andrew Basiego. Mm-hmm. And the most intriguing aspect about one of his visits when he actually time traveled into the past is that it was in the early days of photography, and a photograph was taken at the time he'd traveled back to a particular point, and he later saw the photograph, and there he was in the photograph in the past. Now, for him, that he could say, look, there you are, that's me, there's the proof. But, I mean, of course, we could say, well, how do I know?
All right. It looks just an awful lot like that fella.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, just as a little footnote to that, the intriguing thing was that he was a young man here, and a young man when he travelled, obviously, and he somewhere lost his boots or shoes, and somebody gave him a massive outsized pair. And when you look for it in the photograph, I mean, he's standing in front of a crowd of people, you can actually see that he's got oversized boots on. I mean, it's an interesting point. But there you are. You're interested in the future, and it seems our secret side of life has been looking at all these type of alternatives in travel and whatever, visiting the planets. What about the moon? Do you think we've already been there? I mean, I know we've visited it, but they say there are bases around the dark side of the moon.
I've heard those stories, you know, and I've also heard, you know, people as prestigious as the former science advisor to the president, you know, Richard C. Hoagland, saying that he believes that there's evidence of an ancient lunar archaeological excavation going on up in one of the more prominent craters. And the name of which, again, I used to recall, but you know, when you do so much of this stuff, I think I'm dyslexic with names, and I'm terrible at forgetting people's names and things, and then I try to remember certain facts years and years and years later. And I'm young. It's going to get only worse as time goes on, I guess.
But
I believe that there's some compelling evidence that there may be a little more going on the moon than what our space program has been involved with, and, of course, what the photographs that NASA, you know, put out over the years have shown. I'm not going to be one of those people who will sit here and tell you that I think that clearly, you know, all the photographs from the Apollo 18 missions and or all this, you know, are airbrushed, and that, you know, or rather that, you know, the earlier Apollo missions were actually, you know, performed, I guess, on a soundstage somewhere out in the desert or something like that. There are a lot of very interesting theories about different things like that. And some would even tell you that we never went to the moon at all, that you know, human beings traveling in a spacecraft wouldn't be capable of surviving travel through the Van Allen radiation belt in order to be able to reach the moon. But I think, you know, again, yielding to the research of my compatriot, Nick Redfern. I almost called him Rick Nedfern because that's what we do. we tease Nick unmercifully and call him Rick Nedfern. But Nick wrote a book called The NASA Conspiracies that really, as opposed to getting really far out there and lending credence to all those conspiracies, he says, you know, quite the opposite. It seems that we actually did go to the moon, and that a lot of these theories just simply are that. They're theories that people have put forth. Now, when it comes to the idea of there being a base on the dark side of the moon, there are interesting aspects about that that intrigue me. I know that the Mare planes on the far side of the moon, of course, are very rich in that helium-3 isotope, which some have said would be just a gold mine in terms of renewable energy sources along the lines of fusion, and so that in order to obtain the large quantities of the helium-3 isotope, you know, that are found in the Mare planes on the far side of the moon, one, you know, conceivably would have to travel there. There have also been some stories that I've read over the years that deal with, the technological advantages of being able to have a base parked on the far side of the moon. If it faces away from Earth, that might grant, a greater ability to be able to observe, the greater cosmos utilizing telescopes and things. But the inherent problem there is that in order to be able to get information from Earth to the far side of the moon, at present we're still utilizing radio technologies, and so we'd have to effectively be able to bounce information, I suppose, off of a satellite toward this base on the far side of the moon in order to be able to utilize telescopes and things that would be effectively parked over there. Now, some have said that one of the popular stories about our known missions to the moon is that as the astronauts circled back around the dark side of the moon, coming back down for a landing, that they had actually witnessed what might be called bases of some sort, and that there were structures there on the far side of the moon. Again, I couldn't tell you conclusively that there's information that supports any credibility to those kinds of stories, but there's an inextricably, I think, and very intricately also woven kind of mythos surrounding the intrigue of what may be on that far side, that dark side of the moon, to bring to mind the Pink Floyd album. So, you know, it's a very intriguing concept, and I think that the future potentials for technologically how we'll utilize bases on the far side of the moon, you know, are very, very obvious to us. But by the same token, there's something that we've already been there. I couldn't lend to any veracity to those claims, but I think that it's pretty clear why someone would want to go there if they had.
Yes, indeed. Well, I can remember reading not very long ago that Indigo Swan actually worked as a time traveller for the US government, and one of the references he was given to go to actually was on the far side of the moon. And when he got there, he didn't know he was actually on the moon immediately, but he saw structures there and even beings. And one of the structures that he was near to, he reckoned, I think, was something like a mile high. So here and there you get these claims coming up that support what has been said about what they've seen from the craft just encircling the moon. So that's without what they've seen in the photographs that NASA has taken. So yeah, I think things like that tend to show that there's more, perhaps, to some of the conspiracy theories than what we think.
Perhaps there is, absolutely. But, you know, by the same token, I also look at, you know, John Lear. You got to, you know, take into consideration, you know, John Lear, a highly decorated, you know, pilot and a man who's, to me, his testimony should be, it should amount to something. I mean, it should be taken seriously to an extent. Based on the man's achievements, but by the same token, I've also seen him supply, in conjunction with his appearances on programs like Coast to Coast AM, he's supplied photographs and things like that that often purport to show trees growing on the moon. And I look at those photographs personally, I don't see any trees. I don't see any structures or anything like that either. And so some people, I think that there's certainly some credibility to the potential that there's more going on Earth's lonely little satellite than we probably realize. But by the same token, I see some of these people get so far out there and then they're trying to, you know, literally pine trees and things like that growing on the moon. I just haven't seen evidence for that. And I think it's just, you know, finding that medium. Again, as I'd said earlier in the interview, Mike, you know, as opposed to being someone who's a hardline right-end skeptic or a far out there on the opposite end, you know, believer, I would say, you know, I kind of put myself in the middle and try and look at both sides and see where the logic, you know, seems to come to the center and, you know, where the logical center can be found, you know, in all things. So, you know, certainly there could be some evidence to support these various conspiracy theories, but by the same token, you know, I'm just careful which evidence I go to, I suppose.
Yes. Well, you mentioned Hoagland. I think he is one of the people who has highlighted the anomalies, I think, on both the Moon and Mars, which gives some credence to the fact that, certainly in the case of Mars, that there must have been some form of a highly intelligent civilization on it at some time. So it is interesting what these people pick up, and I think Hoagland's a very much respected person in that respect. So it does make you wonder. I suppose what you do, really, and I do the same thing, is I've got my own ideas, and when I see something that supports it, I remember it. It's always nice to sort of back yourself up.
Oh, certainly. Certainly. It, of course it is. And that's, you know, really, I think what it's all about is that everyone has different perspectives, and as opposed to being one that tries to, you know, cut myself away from everyone and say, I'm going to be the UFO future guy, or I'm going to be the Bigfoot, you know, time traveler guy. You know, I try and take a little of everything and really hear people out and see again where the facts tend to go. And when I was younger and more impressionable researcher, you know, there were a lot of bizarre conspiracy theories and things that I really bought into. And as I've gotten older, I have to say that I think life's gotten a lot more comfortable for me because I, in some ways, because I've you know, shed that way of thinking about certain, you know, aspects of the unexplained. And by the same token, there are a lot of other stark potentials and realities that may have surfaced over the years that do seem more credible and no less unsettling. So, you know, but that's, I think, life. You know, everybody's troubled by different things, and I've chosen, I guess, at this point in my life not to worry about whether there's going to be an alien invasion. The evidence doesn't seem to be pointing in that direction. And if extraterrestrials, for instance, are visiting Earth, they don't seem to be overtly hostile. By the same token, you know, I think that, you know, the potentials of further economic turmoil and things like that could be far more dangerous in the immediate sense than those worries that people have about extraterrestrial invasions and things. And would you believe that that's something I've often been, by my non-UFO friends and people who are more straight-laced, I suppose, in their interests, have been criticized about that. I'll post online about, you know, articles I've written about cosmology and UFOs and things. And, you know, my older, wiser friends, so to speak, you know, will try and say, well, Mikey, you know, it's great that you're interested in this stuff, but we hope you'll grow out of that and start taking a real interest in economy and you know, and politics and government and things like that. And my response is always, you know, I'm well-equipped and prepared to debate those subjects with you just as well, because I'm not just a student of the unexplained. I'm a student of history, economics, you know. I'm a student of, you know, the sciences. And I'm a person who's interested in all these things. And, you know, if you want to talk about, you know, the more practical side of existence, we can certainly debate those kinds of things. But I spent enough years working in talk radio doing that kind of thing. And, you know, that's part of the reason I think I got away from all that, is because I wanted to look at those things that were a little less practical. Mm. And it allowed a little bit greater expansion of the way that we think about our role in this universe. And that's what draws me, and I think that keeps me motivated to research and to follow, you know, reports of UFOs and the potential that we may be visited by exotic life forms from elsewhere.
I think that's a nice way to approach it. But do you think that the reason why some people try to avoid these type of subjects is because they have some sort of fear as to how it might change their lives or their future? I mean, can you get to the bottom of it?
You know, I couldn't profess to be able to get to the bottom of it, but I can tell you this. I think that often, yes, people are afraid of having to change their worldview. You know, they're raised up in the church, you know, as I was. And they want to hold true to those values and things that they learned early in life. Now, me, it's been a constant I guess, progression and a process of taking things that I thought I knew, and not always dumping the baby out with the bathwater, but certainly, as the ancient Easterners would say, emptying my cup. You know, one has to, you know, empty his cup of tea before he can hold any new tea. And so, of course, you know, one has to look at what they know and question as they go. I guess as they go along, they have to question whether the information that they are supplied with at one point is in keeping with something that they may already know. And we begin to learn at that point what things are preconceptions and which may be unfounded, and then what things actually appear to be facts that are supported by other available evidence.
Yes, indeed. Now, one thing I probably should have asked you right at the start is something that's baffled me, and you'll be pleased, no doubt, to explain it. What do you actually mean by the UFO singularity?
Sure. Well, the UFO singularity, you know, when we talk about that term singularity, it can mean a lot of different things. It can be the literal reference to the singularity or the event horizon of a black hole, which is, I think, the same sort of comparison that the mathematician Werner Vinge had been evoking when he discussed what he called a singularity, a point in our future, in reference to a time where our technological advances will be exploding, literally taking off at such a rate that what human life and human ability to perceive reality and to harness technology, you know, it's so far beyond what you or I know today that it's impossible to speculate as to what we will become and how humans will change and differ in that brave new world. And so the UFO singularity borrows both the terminology for that so-called technological singularity, which defined simply would be the creation of intelligence and technologies that exceed natural levels of human intelligence. That could be through combining our brains with computers. That could be through the creation of artificial intelligence, or perhaps a combination of those two. That essentially is what a technological singularity will be. Many futurists would say that we're only a few decades away from the attainment of artificial intelligences, which thereby may be able to replicate themselves, improve upon themselves. And if a technology is potentially smarter than humans, whether or not created by humans, but if a technology is capable of replicating and improving its own levels of intelligence, or perhaps improving levels of human intelligence, again, there's a potential for what we might call a technology explosion or an intelligence explosion, which intelligence levels increase so dramatically and rapidly that we, again, cannot perceive what kinds of byproducts or what kinds of, systems may originate from that kind of an explosion in intelligence that far surpasses natural human intelligence today. When we talk about the UFO singularity, I'm looking at this in much the same way. If technological growth at some point puts us kind of on par with what we perceive as being highly advanced technologies in our midst today, what does that make us, and how does it change the role between what we call ourselves, humans, civilization here on Earth, and what we presume to be extraterrestrial or non-human presences? Are there non-human presences? Will we find out soon? Will we learn about things that we didn't have any concept of now? Will there be new mysteries that arise as we get closer to that quote-unquote singular point? That is what I would call the UFO singularity, and in essence, that's what we try to understand in this book.
Well, thank you for explaining that. You're talking about a different form of intelligence to our own that can advance itself. I suppose you could compare that with the way computers have grown. They can advance their intelligence as long as they are programmed to do that, and can do things that we cannot.
That's certainly the truth, yes. And ideally, in the future, you know, I would argue that computer intelligence, you know, we already have very sophisticated computer systems today. Many would argue that they aren't intelligent. You know, computers aren't capable of thinking and reasoning just yet. By the same token, the beginnings of conscious thought and brain-like activities and processing have already begun to emerge, and even, you know, within the capacities of things so immediately available to most of us as the World Wide Web. And so that being the case, yeah, when we think about the potentials that may await us in terms of how computer or how essentially synthetic technologies and intelligences may allow us to learn not only about ourselves, but to increase levels of technology and the levels of awareness and intelligence and perception. Computers are going to figure into this very, very concisely. And again, in the coming years, we're going to see very clearly that the advances in computer science, are going to probably take us to that next level of what if. And that's what becomes difficult. I don't mean to speak about things too generally, but it's difficult for us to be able to surmise, well, in the next few decades, where are we going to be? We can envision spaceships and things like that flying around. We can envision people with rocket packs, and we can have a kind of Buck Rogers view of the future. But, again, in the Buck Rogers films and things like that, that's fantasy. And we often laugh about the way that these people are wearing Speedos and tight clothing, and they're carrying swords and doing things like that. The sci-fi of yesteryear obviously had a rather simplistic view of what the future would be like, and the future that we're already seeing emerge today is already very, very different from that adventurous kind of motif that would begin to emerge, I guess, in the works of Edgar Rice Burroughs, and of course later authors like H.G. Wells and the like. So I think that what our actual future will be is very different, and it's hard for us to really put our finger on where, as little Mike is in 2 decades from now, where we'll be and what kind of humanity will become as a result of these kinds of technologies.
Yes, I can't help wondering whether perhaps in the case of abductions, which I guess there must be hundreds now that are accredited to the beings that they call the Greys, many people that have been taken on board their craft for this so-called medical examination have commented on the fact that there seem to be small robotic beings that, if this is the correct term, work for the Greys and seem to be quite intelligent in their own way. So perhaps we have unknowingly, perhaps, or some people have already seen that type of thing.
That's the key right there. What if certain extraterrestrial technologies are already utilizing what we might call a post-singularity variety of technology? If alien visitors are coming to Earth, perhaps the way that they have attained levels of technology and intelligence that would allow them to be here and to get here and to travel here would be what we would call, here in Earth terms, post-singularity technologies. And that, effectively, there are aspects of the actual extraterrestrial presence that may be partially what we might call a computer kind of intelligence, or computerized, or a synthetic intelligence. Many people refer to the Greys as acting very robotic, and it could be that these are some form of artificial intelligence themselves.
Yes, indeed. I think I've more or less exhausted my own questions that I had in mind, and it's been very interesting hearing what you've got to say. But is there any aspect that I might have overlooked that you would like to mention before I close the program?
Oh, gosh, at least in terms of ufology and everything, we've covered the majority of it. But I will say to people that, my interests are pretty wide and varied. And although the new book deals with UFOs and where our future technologies may lead us in terms of understanding UFOs, people can visit my website, which is Graliem. That's GralienReport.com. And, of course, there are going to be articles. I've got a weekly podcast that goes up there on the website just as well, which I'm about a week behind on getting those out right now.
Right.
Doing a little early 2013 traveling, but I hope to, not have to be back on the road again until late February when I'll be out there at the International UFO Congress giving a lecture, actually, I guess the first lecture of this year on the UFO singularity. So
folks,
they can visit the website, or if you're going to be in Phoenix, Arizona in February, I'll be lecturing there. And, of course, people can always email me directly. It's info@graliumreport.com.
All right, that's great. What about your book? Where is that available from?
The UFO Singularity can be found in bookstores everywhere. And, of course, those who are familiar with Amazon.com, as many people buy online these days, you can find it there. Or at my website, graliumreport.com, just as well. So pretty much anywhere you want to look for it, you're going to be able to find this one.
Great, yeah. Well, I'm sure it'll be very popular and successful. It's obvious what you've done is approached quite in some ways a common subject, as you pointed out, that many people have researched but more or less made it a directory of UFO sightings.
Right.
You're covering it from a, what seems to be a totally different angle, and it's extremely interesting. So I have to thank you very much for coming onto the program. It's been most enjoyable speaking to you about one of my favorite subjects.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I hope to come back and join you again sometime in the future, okay?
Okay, oh, who knows what you'll have to talk about then.
That's right, Mike. Well, many blessings to you. It's my pleasure to be with you today on Connecting the Light.
Thank you very much. It's been great to be with you. Right, friends, I always say it every week. There was another great guest that we had there. Thoroughly enjoyed that, and he's so knowledgeable, which is brilliant. Next week, I've got Carla Willis-Brandon coming on. She is a licensed marriage and family therapist and author of 12 published books discussing topics ranging from relationships, healthy intimacy, yes, that's what it says, sexual healing, self-esteem, sexual trauma, addiction, and recovery to grief, death, afterlife research, and spirituality. And she has appeared on numerous TV programs and has lectured across the United States and the United Kingdom. So we're going to talk about her latest book called Heavenly Hugs, Comfort, Support, and Hope from the Afterlife. I reckon that sounds pretty interesting. So I hope you can be with me. And thank you for being with me today. God bless you all. Thank you.